size that I want, because that's what Doc says. You have to really emphasize the good feeling that you want. So I'd sit in the computer. My sweetie would be in the kitchen working and looking at his newspapers, but he'd always hear this. I hear this, he'd hear the snap, and all of a sudden I go, "Whoopee, whoopee, whoopee, I really won!" And then he says, "Well," he says, "I think you won, didn't you, honey?" And I says, "Yeah." I says, "I do this, and it really does work." And with Phil Gallum, he says, "Do it before." So I do it and try to set it up. I went from, I got a 70% win rating, and I would win, like, I'd go home and I'd say I won 4 races out of 6. And my sweetie would say, "No, honey, you have to do better." And then I'd win 3 out of 6. "Honey, you have to do better." And I says, "I got a 70% win niche or rating." He says, "No, honey, you have to do better." So I tried shifting everything around, and my win rating went down. And so finally I talked to Doc, and he says, "You know, why not put a rubber band around his neck, and when he starts to talk to you, you know, just go beep." And so I went home and I did tell him. I says, he says, "You can tell him that." And I says, "There," and I says, "You are intimidating me." And I says, "I do what I thought was doing best." And he says, "Well, we want the best for you, honey." But I says, "You keep telling me, and I keep trying a different method." So I went back, and with the help of Vic Palermo and Doc, I got my win rating back up to 70%. And I don't listen to my sweetie. I said, you know, and I said, then he starts to come looking at me, and I said, And so, but it really does work. And I wear this constantly. Not only does it tell me that I hit it to win, but every time I look at that rubber band, I tell them at work, everyone, because they always ask, "Why are you carrying the rubber band? You know, you are not carrying a package with you or anything like that." I says, "No, every time I glance at that rubber band, it tells me I am a winner." And that's what it just done for me. Thank you.
Anytime your sweetie asks you how you did, knock them down. Yeah.
Put my rubber band right here.
Okay. around your money. Yeah. Well, we'll give you an extra one to put around your money. If you're, how many of you are left-handed? Oh, you should be winners automatically. If you're left-handed, put it on your right wrist. If you're right-handed, put it on your left wrist. If you're ambidextrous, ask for another rubber band. But don't use it for negatives. Here's where it works the best. How many of you, in all honesty, you get at the track and you've made your selections at home and you've got your readouts and you know what you're going to do, and all of a sudden you look at them and everything blurs and you get this strange, horrible feeling in your stomach, like, "What the hell am I doing here? Nobody can win at this game. I've been dreaming all my life. I've been misled. I've been deluded." And everything blurs and then you get dizzy. You ever had that feeling? Am I the only one that ever had that? Used to happen to me all the time in the beginning. I thought, where am I going to get off trying to tell people that we can learn how to do this thing? And there are a lot of discouraging moments. And these discouraging moments, you don't want to recall with anything. You want to replace them with positive moments. And you have positive moments. The problem with people in a gambling situation is they tend to not remember the positive moments with the same emotion that they remember the negative moments. So what you do is, whenever you do something right, I don't care what it is, if one of your horses came in the money, or if you picked an exacto, or if you had a winner, like this young man who just showed me his, he had a $16 winner, what was it, $60 exacto or something, just went up with Jimmy and did a race. 40? Well, you know, I have a tendency to, you know, multiply everything by 50%. It's called hyperbole, I guess. But anyway, that's still pretty good. Every time you have a good moment, every time you have done it right, whether it be at home or at the track or wherever, every time you have done something and you're satisfied and gratified with what you do, snap the hell out of that. Hear it snap and feel the pain. If you don't feel the pain, you don't get no gain now. And when pretty soon you're going to do so well that you're going to have to go around with red wrists. You've heard of red necks, huh? You're going to be known as a red wrist. And I like to have people say, well, certain people, they all got red wrists. But every time something good happens with you in this field, I brought Carolyn up here, and I can bring in 10 more people. A lot of people don't believe this. They call it the psychological crap. Oh my God, we got to hear that before we get the questions answered. But this is where it is at, if you'll pardon the language. It's in the mind. The difference between those who do consistently win and those who do not is not in their computer program. It is in their mind. The computer program is a tool, just as a hammer and a scissors, and hammer and nails and scissors and pliers and whatever else people use. I never did that kind of work myself, so I don't know what they use. But carpenters and seamstresses and other professions have their tools. These are your tools, but only you can be the carpenter. Only you can be the plumber and the builder who properly uses the tools. Let the rubber band help you, folks. Believe in it. It has truly been proven by all the behavioralists who have applied it. There are many, many people walking around today who were so happy when they were drunks, who are now sober because of the damn rubber band. So turn it around the other way. Turn it around the other way and consider that when you were not winning, you were as a drunk, and snap the rubber band and get sober. Or the other way around, let yourself become drunk on the ecstasy of consistent winning. That ends that session. Now we'll get down to the informational part. Jimmy? Tom? We call this crossfire. You have seen the precise, highly articulate manner in which Tom Brohammer goes through a race, analyzing it from multiple facets, and you have remarked on what it magnificent person he is in being able to do this so articulately. One person told me how to go on a lecture circuit, and I said, what do you think this is? And you've also seen where Jimmy sometimes seems to do it with some kind of magic, some kind of mysticism. Over the years, although it is not as apparent now as it what has been in the past, over the years people have thought that Jimmy had one totally different approach and Tom another. But as we listen to them and have them answer your questions, and I'll be the interlocutor, you will find out that it is not the technique, it is not the approach, it is the end result that counts. And the end result of both of them is the same. They are both winners, as this young gentleman who Jimmy took out and helped in the book just now will testify. So I'll come over to the table and we'll start asking the questions.
You hear this? No. I don't need one of these rubber bands. I have one that they have me snap when I go past the schoolyard already. All right, let's have some questions, Howard.
This is going to go all the way. Bradshaw's getting sick, so we're going to have to go through. A lot of people, we promised in the flyer that we sent out before we started the questions themselves, and this question has been asked a number of times, these questions, so we're going to paraphrase your question and get three, or at least two different perspectives on the subject of... And when somebody... Okay, thank you, Spencer. Without whom we would have done it much quicker. Is everything okay now, Spencer? You really have done a marvelous job this morning. The hotel did not provide us with enough seats, with enough tables, with the microphones, and Spencer was on that phone and running around like crazy, helping us out. And so if you hear us kidding, it's out of love, mostly. And that's the subject of adjustments. How many of you, and since we have a lot of newcomers, I'm sure a lot of you were raised on the subject of the necessity of part-time. Turn yours off, that's the way. How many of you are devotees of part-times and have found it very difficult? It's all right, raise your hand. There's nothing wrong with this. You find it very difficult to evaluate a race without thinking in terms of part-times because the efficacy of pars has been established over the years by so many authors. How many of you do part-times not worry at all? Okay, what we want to do here is, for those who are not worried about them, not to start worrying about them because we're going to do this session. For those who are worried about them, we want them to learn how to use them from the best expert in the North America. Probably the world, but we don't have far as North America, don't we? Now, I want to preface this. I know all of his mainstream friends. He is the only man that I've ever seen use part-time concept properly and successfully, because he doesn't do it the way the others do. And he's tried to teach it over the years, and very few people have learned it. So we will go into the concept, because we also have pars in our programs. Our pars are based not on the average times run over the past season or two, but on what we call the dream race, which is a par set up by the actual contestants in the race. Tom uses, in his own unconventional way, the conventional pars. So we'll start with Tom, so he can apprise you of how he does it and conceptually why he does it.
All right, to begin with, most people overuse these pars, and most people are adjustment happy, and I'll start with that. How many of you, I mean, does everyone understand what pars are, first of all? Just to make sure we're all together on that. Everybody understands that. Then let me tell you how I use them, and the way I think is optimal in the use of pars. First of all, the balance or the equalization of racetracks. If you were to take a horse, for example, that runs at the $10,000 level at Pimlico, and ship that horse to Southern California, they look like they were from different planets, because one just runs slower at that level than they do in California, because they're faster racetracks. And the use of pars, for example, if they run 111.3 at Pimlico, that's about the same as a 110.2 at Santa Anita. And that's good information to have, because if you don't have that, one looks like just a much slower racehorse, and it's really not. Now that's that kind of thing, the balance between racetracks, is the number one for me use of pars. The number two use of pars, once you understand the par or the class hierarchy at your racetrack, you will gain some insights into that track. And the single most valuable point I think I can make on the use of pars is to be able to understand when, for example, a maiden winner is good enough to step into an allowance race, a non-winner's a one, and when that horse is probably not good enough. And that's a valuable insight, a very valuable insight. So a maiden that wins in 110 flat, which is about par at Santa Anita, has run a maiden race. Now if it steps in against non-winners of ones, which run 109.3 or 109.2, that horse is not a strong contender unless you can find another line that makes it that. So that's a way of looking at that maiden and saying they're probably not going to fit with these allowance horses. Granted, horses run against horses. They don't run against pars. On the other hand, when you get a race that you have a horse that can run to par, you'd better have a very good argument for betting one of the horses that can't. Finally, as horses go from class level to class level, it's good to know what the par was at each level so you can evaluate whether that horse is capable of making that two or three level jump to the next level. If a horse wins for 20 and runs 109.2 in Southern California, that horse can make the jump to 32 without a problem. If the horse runs 109.4 or 110 at 20, it's not going to make that jump and ought to stay where it is. And that's a valuable insight to know whether or not the horse should be stepped up off of a powerful win. Because if it's not, like Chile, Missouri ran the other day, should have been stepped up, was not, and at a very short price it got beat. And you see that all the time. Now that's the best use of pars, and I wouldn't carry it past that. And if you don't do it now and you're successful with it, fine, but it's an additional insight. And I've had several people tell me at this seminar that they've gone to the trouble of finding the par structure at their racetrack, and all of a sudden they understood things they did not understand before. The relationship between the state breds and the others, for example. The relationship between a $20,000 claiming horse and a 32. And that's the most valuable use of pars. And I would draw the line right there, because I really don't go beyond that except in making the variance.
Gotcha.
In the use of pars in a stretch out, yeah, I mean, if you, for example, know that a $10,000 claiming horse sprints at about 110.2 in Southern California, at Hollywood Park, for example, the par at a mile of 16th is about 143.3. That's good information to have, because if the horse is sprinting at 110 and 1 and all our routers are going 144 and 1, the at least theoretically, that horse should stretch out and beat those routers every time, if the horse will cooperate and go that far. If on the other hand, the horse is running 111 and the routers are all going 144, that 111 stretches out to about 144 and 2, and now it's no longer that great bet to beat those routers. And that's a great insight to have. It's knowledge about your racetrack that I really think is an edge. It's your call on that, whether you choose to use them or not.
We started, back when I started in 75 and through about 1982, 1983, I had read the whole thing on pars, and I was gung-ho for creating pars and par-type adjustments and everything. I had nothing whatsoever against them. It's not Jimmy's, maybe Jimmy's opinion is, because he came a little later, is against them. But what my problem was that we had Tom do seminars, not only in Beaumont, but he did a couple in Long Beach and went to people's homes at their request and had small groups and tried to teach his technique. We have a lady from Seattle as a guest professional here who does this very same thing for various tracks and makes pars. And we find that very few people have the talent, not only just to make them is easy, but to use them properly is very difficult. So our job, when Jimmy became our major domo on the computer, was to come up with something that would give you an adjustment that would be equal to or comparable to or make you just as good a winner without going to the trouble of understanding how to use the pars. So we are not talking against the subject of pars, we are talking about the reality of how many people can just not properly use them. So we came up with a dream race par. The dream race is the best possible first, second, third fraction and second call that can be run by the mix and match of the contenders in the race. Those are the actual times they ran, whether they came from four different tracks, three different tracks, or all from the same track or from a variety of distances. Those represent what the horses potentially run against, which is in itself, if you want to take the derivative of the word par, which is parameter, it is a form of par. Now, as to the technical aspects of it, the man who put it into a program, into a series of programs, which suffices very well, at least for David Barrios and a few a dozen others that I've seen, here's Jimmy Bradshaw.
Well, the way Tom explained it, maybe I do use pars to a certain extent, because I do look at what a horse can do at one track and what he does at another. Now, you've got to understand that Tom is an expert in the field of making variants, and on Southern California, the circuit that he plays, he really understands this track. I don't have this luxury of having a home track, so to speak. Unless you want to call Remington Park a home track, which has a split season and has a lot of shippers coming in from all over the country. But I just use the racing form to look and find out, say, a horse that ran at one track, what he runs at the other. If I don't have it, I've had enough experience playing these tracks that I know basically what the difference is. I know how a horse can stretch out based on how he ran his first two calls. I don't have to stretch out to a 6.5 furlong. If I don't know, I find one in the race that has stretched out. So, I'm really establishing a type of a parameter. I wouldn't know how to go about doing it the way that Tom does it, but I can do it from the racing form. And in the type of playing that I do, it has to be down and dirty, because I play numerous tracks all over the country. I go to Oakland Park during the off season and play simulcast. They simulcast three tracks. I go to Kansas City and they simulcast three tracks. I come to Las Vegas and I will play all of the tracks. And the information that I use, I guess you could call them par times, that a par at Aqueduct at the first quarter mile is slower than at Belmont and at Saratoga. I know these things by looking them up. and see and make my my wagers according to this. I may add a fifth of a second here, a fifth of a second there, knowing this in advance. When I put them into the computer and use the computer, the dream race pars. Do this, I still do it with the matchup. And this has a tendency to equalize these horses. So not having the luxury of having a track next door, I'm a suitcase handicapper. You know, even Remington Park is 2 hours from my home. Hot Springs is 5 hours and Kansas City is 5 hours. So I don't have this luxury of having a track that I could just call home. I'm hoping to, because the Indians are trying to put one in Tulsa. Hooray for the Indians.
I'm pretty much a slave to what you are, those of you with the least of you. Well, I have a problem when I have to handicap. I have to do it the way I think the clients do. I don't have the luxury of coming up with something on my own that only I can do, that I can't convey. So I just use the computer blindly, and I find that the adjustment called for will be correct if I have put in appropriate pace lines. The Dream Race Par creates an adjustment based A, on the horses running against each other, and then they're adjusted to the dream race. And their relationship to the dream race creates the adjustment. Now the one adjustment is, let's say the one adjustment was 1.36. That 1.36 is distributed over the three fractions of that horse proportionate to the way it exerts its energy. If it exerts 36% of its energy in the first fraction, it gets 36 of that adjustment. If it's 34 in the second, it gets 34% of the adjustment, etc. That has never failed me. It has always been very good. I have never had any problem, and the secret, of course, is putting the appropriate horses into the computer. If you do that, either way will work. The thing about pars is, Dunbrohammer's way is, you have a greater feeling of confidence, because if you are a devotee of pars, because you know exactly how they were made and exactly from whence your adjustments come. If you're not a devotee of pars, you probably wouldn't be able to work them correctly anyway. I hope that answers the question on the two different kinds of pars. The end result is usually the same. When Tom Sensby races, for instance, he does himself change the lines, but I never see the changes he makes. He just says, here, take one of these pace lines and put it in the computer and see if you can get the winner. Invariably, because he's changed the lines and I don't know what he's changed them to, the two adjustment gets me the same horses that Tom gets. And sometimes, and in one case, it got the winner in a better position, and the other case, his pars got the winner in a better position. That's one way and one the other way, and the middle was exactly the same. So with that subject closed, we will now go on to a question which is directly related to it. This question is very interesting, and we're going to comment it. I think all of you guys should comment on the nature of the question as opposed to the answer. The nature of the question suggests that his computer tells him that 80 to 90% of all of his races require a two adjustment. Yet in the manual it says that the two adjustment is not used, seldom used that much. So what's wrong? What is wrong with someone's selections? What is wrong with his contenders if 80 to 90% of the time the computer says he needs a two adjustment? You know enough about that to answer.
I only have one question that I'll turn back at you. Are you winning races, and are you winning races satisfactorily? And if the answer to that is yes, what the heck difference does the question make? I'm serious now. That is the bottom line to all of this, whether you can put a plus or a minus on your money. Now, if you're not winning races and you're being asked for the two adjustment that often, then my first reaction to that is you're putting in wrong horses and or wrong pace lines. That would be, if I got the two adjustments. See, one of the things is I almost never get a request for the two adjustment. Of course, I'm adjusting the lines based on the variant. Now, maybe you have some wild swings on your racetrack. It could be, you could have one horse that ran on a slow 9, another one ran on a fast 8, and somewhere along the way you're going to get a request for a two adjustment. That's one thing. But if you're winning races, and if you're not winning races and you're getting that request a lot, maybe you're putting in the wrong horses and the wrong lines. That's just my reaction to that.
I have the same reaction that most of the time it is it's a bad horse. But sometimes, you know, when we say bad horse, we say bad lines. Horse coming off the mud or from some other track may be legitimate. But you've got to understand, we say that it's within 2 points of the total energy. But now this total energy, you may have a real, real fast horse in that, like Howard showed you on one of the programs last night, that needs a negative adjustment, and a real slow horse. Whereas if you took out the real slow horse, they would fall into line and it would not need it to adjust. Always remember that those windows pop up before with less than two. I always suggest that go on through the program, look at your opposite screen, and then look at the first screen on the adjusted total energy, and you may find that it brought it within a parameter of two or close enough to two that there isn't a needed adjustment. Another thing is find horses that have equivalent first, second, and third diffractions. Find these horses. You know, don't put in horses that ran against 47s unless there was an excuse. If there was an excuse, don't be afraid to go back on the horse. You know, if you've got a pace line on a horse that looks like a 22-2, 45-2, and 111-1, you know, don't put in 22-4s, 46-3s, 112s, unless this horse is coming from another track. And there's a good way to find out if he's coming from another track. Look at other horses and see what they do when they make this change. May find that it isn't necessary. The gentleman last night that had the 6.5 on the dirt and 6.5 on the turf. You know, look at those. There's ways to adjust those horses. You know, find out what this 6.5 furlong down the hill did when he was on the dirt. Or some of these other dirt horses, what they did when they were on the turf in other lines, if possible. If not, look at other horses in the race and see how much they improve. I guess what I'm trying to say is maybe even set you up a type of part-time before you even put them into the computer.
This is very subjective, in other words. When the horse was changing from Hollywood Park to Del Mar, 80% of mine came up needing a two adjustment because of the difference between the Hollywood and Del Mar when you had mixed shippers coming in. The circumstances governed it. But Tom's answer was the best. If you're winning with a two adjustment, you're probably getting higher mutuals than with the other. That's why when in your reports I had you do it both ways. After 20 races, doing it both ways, you should see which one is getting you the best results and go on that. I just do not do what Tom and Jimmy do. I'd love to. I did back before I was responsible for other people's winning, but when I'm responsible for others, I have to do it the way I tell them to do it. And it hasn't hurt me too much, so I just follow the instructions. And when it comes up on that screen and says, before you use the two adjustment, make sure this horse is a true contender. I do what I did yesterday in my demonstrations. I go to the three and see who's getting the big negative or who's getting the big positive. I determine which horse is causing the necessity for the two. And I appraise that horse again. If I say he belongs, I use the two. Simple as that. Really. And Jimmy, just to answer another question we had, is how come sometimes that flag comes up at less than two? That's because it's adjusted, it's set at less than two. When it comes up, that's when it suggests it's needed. This question has been asked seven times, so we have to answer it. And I guess I'm the only one who knows the answer, because I put it in on page 6 of the workbook. So if you want to turn to page 6, it wants me to identify the spot plays that we show in there. Here's a good way for you to make money while you're practicing. Let me emphasize one thing, and Tom and Jim will emphasize it with me. The way we learned how to do it was by doing it. That's it. You sit in front of that computer and you run race after race after race, and theoretically, snap your rubber band occasionally while you're doing that, theoretically you learn something from each race you do. You see corollaries, you see readouts that are predictive, and all sorts of things. When you get on page 7, look at the first X, which is horse number 2. And Thoromation, the winner was second. On the EXDC screen, the winner was second. On the sustained pace screen, the winner was second. This winner survived both the EXDC and the sustained pace screen and Thoromation. In other words, it was in the top two on all three screens. Looking over onto your alternate adjustment, the horse appeared in the top two in two screens. This is a means, very simply, folks, very simply. Look, think of it conceptually and logically. This means that this horse was so good, was so strong, as Jimmy would say, that it survived the two and came up by nature on the one. These are spot plays which have been yielding people 80%. So if you are in doubt about adjustments, while you're learning, while you are practicing, use these spot plays. That question's been asked many, many times, so I'll take care of it. All right, Tom. This probably has to do something with pars, and it may require two different answers. Talking about turn time, which is a second fraction, how do you know if a horse coming from 6.5 to, or 7 furlongs turn time is comparable to a 6 furlong turn time, and do you adjust it, and if so, how? And how do you adjust a one-turn mile? This must be from the east or from Midwest somewhere. How do you adjust a one-turn miler going into a two-turn? That's your favorite subject.
Well, see, that's a piece of cake. We'll deal with the first one first. The one-turn miler. When Hollywood Park had the one-turn mile, all I did was take the Hollywood Park fractional times for the one-turn mile, compare it to the two-turn mile of the 16th, and adjust the fractions by that difference. Very simply, that was the way to do that. And then I took the final time and equated that to the mile of the 16th time. Granted, one was a mile, one was a mile 16th, but it's easy to find comparable values. For example, 137 and 3 is worth about 144 and 2 where I live. So if it was 137 and if it was 144 and 2 in the mile 16, I'd make it 137 and 3 in the round, in the mile. It was a matter of just, it was a function of the par times. I think that's a very easy question to answer. Now the other one, the turn times, see, I don't make any adjustments to the turn times. I just understand, like you should or will from pace handicapping, is that they run faster, they run the 7 furlongs on the straightaway. They run a couple of lengths faster at times than they do at 7 furlongs than they do at 6. On the other hand, at 7 furlongs, they often take a hold of the horse out of the gate, and they actually run slower. So it's just a tricky proposition. So when you get an artificially fast turn time at 7 furlongs, you just have to understand that it was run on a straightaway. Make no adjustments to it, because it could be a function of the first quarter. But just understand that if it's artificially fast, it is artificially fast. Yes? I approach the 7.5 the same way, but I cut it back to 7 furlongs because it is basically a sprint. It's an elongated sprint. So I take, for example, the 7.5 at Hollywood and the 7 at Hollywood. The fractions are run pretty close to one another, so I don't spend a lot of time with the internal fractions of that race. But if it's 129 and 3 is the final time at 7.5 furlongs, because if you put 7.5 in, you get a distorted final fraction because of that odd distance. So if he takes 129 and 3, the comparable time at Hollywood Park is 122 and 4, so you change the distance to 7 furlongs. You made a very minor change, and now the horse is workable with the other horses you have in your mix.
Let me not be a heavy here, sir, please. I know I'm going to be a heavy. But here's what happens. We had all these people who went to the trouble of writing these out, and if we start changing our rules in midstream, we have hurt the people we promised that they had to write about. I'm sorry.
It's still a function of the pars.
Tom will talk to you, would be delighted to talk to you in private.
No, I won't.
How about that?
We're finished.
I did my time, too. I pointed this out in the fall, and I'm going to have Tom do it. Find one of your races, Tom, that you like. Tom has a marvelous technique that he taught us all years ago when I was at his feet. And that is, people look at 10 pace lines and they get confused. Oh my God, I got to look at 10 pace lines and analyze this horse. Tom has a marvelous way of taking a horse's thing and telling you to cross off, and sometimes as many as 6 of the 10 lines, sometimes less. And then you're only looking at 4 to 5 lines sometimes. And it makes it much, much easier for you to determine which is the pace line you should use. So while Tom's finding a race where he can demonstrate to this to the page, we'll go on to one more question.
Just try to find where you put it.
I'm going to just do this one. Oh, this is kind of an answer. Sometimes the flag comes up when there's not a full 2-point distance, and when the flag comes up, that's the warning. Never mind what you perceive the difference is. Jimmy's got a little little guy with a hat on in there to let you know when it should be. I think last night we demonstrated you could put a mile and a quarter into your computer and it will convert. And somebody did ask the question, what's the longest distance you can put in? And a mile and a quarter is the answer. Okay, you got something, Tom?
Well, the reason it's taking me so long is that the light here is so bad, I'm trying to find one that I can read.
Oh, then I remember when you were a kid.
No, when I was a kid. All right, let's for those of you with the hymn book, go to page 25. Now, this is something we started doing at Saratoga a couple of years ago. I've been doing it for a long time, but I suggested we formalize it a little bit to the group, and the feedback's been really good. The pace line selection thing. Once you've been doing it for a while, once you're successful at this, the pace lines, as Howard used to say, kind of loom at you. They do. They become all kind of automatic. But sometimes they're very confusing, and the horse's form is very confusing. Can we get a pencil?
All right.
So on page 25, if you were selecting or trying to analyze the form of Town Caper, for example, the best way to do that is to block out the superfluous data in his past performances. In other words, the lines that really have no bearing, except possibly in terms of current form, on today's race. Now, once you've done that, and we'll do it together here on this horse in a moment, but once you've done that, the pace line selection process becomes a lot easier, as does the horse's consistency. Because quite often, you'll take a horse that has been running over its head, off and on, way over its head, not just one level, that doesn't count, but way over its head, at wrong distances, and then when you line out all of the races that don't apply to today's conditions, you'll find that horse is actually very consistent. In the case of Town Caper, just take a line and strike it through the top line. Take a pencil and strike it through that mile on the turf. The horse's record in two starts has never hit the board in the turf. So get rid of it.
It's not all that bad a race, but get rid of it anyway because it has no bearing on a 6-furlong race right now, especially a claiming race. Jump down 4 lines to the turf race and get rid of that race. Now look at this horse's performance. Now sometimes you'd get rid of a lot more than that, but now look at the horse's consistency. Granted, it was against 3-year-olds, and that's why we disqualified the horse in this race. But now look at this horse. If you line the top one, you line the second top one, and you line the fourth one down, this horse becomes very consistent, doesn't it? This is a nice horse, he tries. And now as you choose your pace line, it becomes a lot easier to choose the pace line for today's race based on that data. You get rid of all of those other races, and if you choose them, you're making a mistake anyway. On most horses, if you choose races that don't apply to today, you've made a mistake. And you would do that on all of the rest of the horses, including Rapsala, although you can choose any line on the horse. Outlawed, now let's look at Outlawed for just a moment. Go down. Even though it was in 92 and the horse was a lot cheaper, I'd probably throw out all of the 92 things because when he came back to the races after the long layoff, he was just a lot better horse. But I'd go down about 5 races and line through that mile race. And I'd line through the top race. That's the one we decided he really didn't belong in, did he? And then you would find races that he had big excuses in. Like on the very bottom, it says he broke slowly. And he broke from the one post at Hollywood Park, he broke slowly. And when you do that, you're just kind of out of things, even though he didn't run badly, but draw a line through that race. And once you've done that, another one, 5 back today was claimed, he took up at the half. Now that's a serious trouble line. So draw a line through the one where he's got the 75 buyer rating, 4 back. I don't think I've missed any others here. So now look at his fast performances. He's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 sprints in here that are somewhat comparable to what he's going to do today, even though somewhere at a lower level. And you might also want to draw a line through those and just find out what he's done at this level. But nevertheless, the exercise is still the same. In all of those races, he only has 1 bad effort, doesn't he? And you'll find it as you do that with most horses, you'll have a lot clearer picture as to what the horse can do and does do. I suggest you do that for a while if you're not already doing it. You'll find the whole process is just simplified and a lot clearer.
This question can best be answered by personal observation, which I'm going to encourage personal observation. The question reads, is it true that on the energy generator or the kinetic generator, if all of them are sustained or sustained presser, or if all are early and there's only one sustained presser, in other words, if there's a lone early with the rest of them being sustained and presser, and there's a lone sustained when the reverse is true, is it true that that the early will win when the rest are all sustained? Is it true that the sustained will win when the rest are all early? That is something which is totally dependent on your handicap. If you want a trend, I always say watch out for a lone deviant. But you have to, it has to be based on your handicap. And if you put in seven horses and the winner's not in there, it means absolutely nothing. If you put in seven horses and four of them don't belong, then those readouts mean nothing. The only way you can get the answer to this, and I think the gentleman will agree with me, we won't have to labor, is sit and do 50 races and ask yourself these kinds of questions from the screens as you see them, and you will have the answer based on your handicapping and the circumstances of your track. The other half of this question is, if they're all sustained, should I bet the earliest of the sustained or the most sustained of the sustained? Ordinarily, logic would say that you want a horse that's a sustained horse that is out in front of the other sustained horses. However, if that doesn't win, then you don't do that. You do what works from your own personal observation. Anybody got anything to comment? I mean, it's a tough thing to give absolutes like that. Jimmy, you want to?
The only thing is that probably you would. But you want to look back to and make sure that you haven't left out an early horse. Because this early horse that can't win, you may have left out of your computer. And then you would want probably the best that can run against today's pace. So this is what I would look for. When you're saying, well, all of them say sustained and they're all sustained, is everyone in the race sustained? And who is the best of the early? These are decisions that you've got to make before you make a decision of which of these sustained can win the race.
And one quick follow-up here. Be careful with the mix you've got in the computer in the first place, that you've chosen a representative race. Because there was a race run Wednesday here that was won by a horse called Of Eagles. And this race went extremely fast early for that class level. I mean extremely fast. And then slowed down dramatically late. Now, everybody in that race is going to look early when compared to horses of comparable ability because they were all stuck trying to keep close during that very fast pace. So now when you look at it next time, you're liable to get an early reading on one of those deep closers out of that race when you compare it to everybody else. So make sure you got apples and apples in that computer when you do that. Otherwise, you get trapped a lot by saying, well, one of the horses out of that is an early horse, but the horse wouldn't take the lead if you put a gun to its head, possibly.
The question that Jimmy's already answered, but I'll remind you that he answered it. How does Jimmy compare fractions when horses are coming from one track to another, like where he meets this problem all the time? He sees enough races. You know how many races there are? Say you're at Remington and you've got Trinity Meadows coming in, you've got Louisiana Downs coming in. How does he know? He looks at the 10 lines for the Louisiana Downs horse and see what they do at Louisiana Downs, and he looks to see what they do at this track, and he finds the horse that came to this track in Louisiana Downs. He takes the information in the racing form and he just extrapolates the fractions. You have all the shipping information you need right there in the racing form. And folks, if you could come across a horse from a track that has no information on it, one race at one track, then there's a thing that you can do. You can handicap the next race. Now, this will get the guys. That's what started these guys, what started the crossfire. These old boys fighting on this one. So we can take it from Jimmy's standpoint. Hey, Jimmy, in doing your matchup, how do you compare? How do you make a model? And Tom Brohammer, when you're making your model, how do you do the matchup? In other words, is it necessary to keep a model when you use the matchup to get contenders? Oh, boy, here we go.
I don't keep a model. But you got to understand that, like I said before, I don't
play. I said last night.
I don't play one track consistently. I play many tracks. And I know how or feel how a race is going to run by looking at the past performances of the horses in the race. Now this, said, well, what if you did keep a model? I've never kept a model. I wouldn't know how to read one. And I know Tom keeps one, and he keeps a pretty tight one. But I know that he will sway from this model if the matchup determines that this is what is going to happen in today's race. The matchup, in my opinion, supersedes any model, any profile, or anything else. I think that the matchup, I don't only think it, I know it in my own mind that it is the only way to handicap a horse race.